A reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 20, Lord Vishnu's Appearance in the Sacrificial Arena, Text 8. Ya evam santam atmanam atmastam veda purusha najate prakriti stopi tadgunai samayistita ya evam santam atmanam Atma stambhira purusha Najate prakriti stopi Tadgunai samayistita Ya evam santam atmanam Atma stambhira purusha Najate prakriti stopi Tadgunai samayistita Ya evam santam atmanam Atmastam veda purusha Najate prakriti stopi Tadgunai samayistita Ya evam santam atmanam Atmastam veda purusha Najate prakriti stopi Tadgunai samayistita Ya evam santam atmanam Atmastam veda purusha Najate prakriti stopi Tadgunai samayistita Ya. Anyone who. Evam. Thus. Santam. Existing. Atmanam. The individual Atma. And the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Paramatma. Atmastam. Situated within his body. Veda. Knows. Purusha. Person. Na. Never. Ajate. Is affected. Prakriti. In material nature. Sta. Situated. Api. Although. Tatgunai. By the material modes of nature. Sa. Such a person. Mai. In me. Stita. Situated. Translation. Although within the material nature, one who is thus situated in full knowledge of the Paramatma and Atma is never affected by the modes of material nature, for he is always situated in my transcendental loving service. Please repeat. Although within the material nature, one who is thus situated in full knowledge of the Paramatma and Atma is never affected by the modes of material nature. For he is always situated in my transcendental loving service. Purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. When the Supreme Personality of Godhead appears in this material world, he is not affected by the modes of material nature. Similarly, those who are always connected with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, even though they be within the material body or the material world, are not affected by the material qualities. That is explained very nicely in Bhagavad Gita 14:26. Mam cha yo vyabhicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunam samajaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who is unflinchingly engaged in the devotional service of the Lord surpasses the material qualities and attains Brahman realization. In this connection, Srila Rupa Goswami says that if a person is always engaged in the service of the Lord with his body, words, and mind, he is to be considered liberated, although living in the material world. Translation again. Although within the material nature, one who is thus situated in full knowledge of the Paramatma and Atma is never affected by the modes of material nature, for he is always situated in my transcendental loving service. Shri Chaitanya Manavishtam Stapitam Yenabhutale Sayadupavaramayam Dadati Swabhadantikam. Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Shri Vasari Gaura Bhaktivinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. It's always interesting that the onus to be responsible, or the onus to be act properly, act like a devotee, the onus to do that is always on the devotee, if we consider ourselves devotees, aspiring devotees. Then the onus to act properly is always on us. And in that famous letter that Srila Prabhupada wrote famous letter, and now I'm struggling to remember who he wrote it to, either Karandar, I think it was Karandar that he wrote it to. This famous phrase that he used, that the Krishna consciousness movement is to train independently thoughtful people. So that onus to act properly isn't something that we should expect to be told all the time, or that we have to necessarily refer to somebody all the time to see how it is that we should act, or how it is that we should act properly. We also have to, at some point, we have to know what that behavior is. And the Bhagavad Gita extensively elaborates on what the behavior of a devotee is like that. So in this pastime that we're discussing now, we had the situation where Lord Indra was not acting properly, and he basically, at least as it's described in the pages of the Bhagavatam, he was jealous, he was envious of Prithu Maharaj. I guess we can all identify with those emotions, that the emotion of jealousy. Jealousy is kind of like a slightly milder version of envy. But of course, if we are experiencing jealousy, we should know that if we don't check it, that very soon it can descend, turn into envy, which is a very powerful, disruptive and decaying anarta, the anarta of envy. So, you know, Prithu Maharaj had performed 99 sacrifices, horse sacrifices, and he was on his 100th, and this was going to surpass Lord Indra. So Lord Indra didn't like this, so he decided that he was going to... It reminds me of the pastime in Krishna book, the Dravida gorilla pastime, where, you know, Dravida wanted to destroy all the sacrificial arenas and make them contaminated so as that they couldn't be used properly like that. I remember actually when my children were young, sort of, you know, I'm not sure exactly what age, but sometime between the age of sort of 2 and 5 or 2 and 6, whatever that kind of age. And myself and my wife used to take turns reading Krishna book to them every night. The motivation was to read Krishna book, but there was a secondary motivation, was to get them to sleep. But anyway, we used to read a different verse every night. And my youngest son, who was probably 3 at the time, something like that, we came to the pastime of Dravida Gorilla, and we read it. I can't remember who read it first, but whoever was reading it. Anyway, I remember when I was reading it, and he was just in hysterics. He was just absolutely in convulsions of laughter. He was just enjoying this chapter so much that the next night, when it came to move on to the next chapter, he just threw a tantrum and said, no, I want to hear Dravida Gorilla, Dravida Gorilla. And every night for about 2-3 months, we were stuck on reading Dravida Gorilla. And he was just in ecstasy every single night reading it. Unfortunately, he wasn't in ecstasy when Lord Balaram sorted Dravida Gorilla out. He was just in ecstasy of Dravida Gorilla urinating on the sacrificial arenas and flashing and doing all these like outrageous things. He was really enjoying it. And then I realized that, well, maybe our Garbhananda Samskara wasn't as good as we thought it was. Anyway, he's turned out to be a reasonable young man, and he doesn't urinate on sacrificial arenas or flash. Thank God, thank Krishna. Anyway, this pastime just reminds me a little bit of that pastime, because you have Indra out of envy. He wants to stop Maharaj Prithu at all costs from completing the 100th sacrifice. And, you know, he devises different ways to steal the horse from the arena. And he does it on a couple of occasions. And then, interestingly, Prabhupada, he disguises himself as a sannyasi, And of course, as we know, in Vedic culture, and that culture is very much carried on into at least to some degree into modern day Indian culture. And we see how respected anybody is that wears saffron, who walks around, you know, any place in India, really, that they're still very much revered and respected. So Indra was, you know, trying to escape the arena, you know, so he dressed as a sannyasi so that he would, you know, escape without, or at least if anybody noticed him, they would, even if they thought there was something funny, that they would get a little bit bewildered or a little bit kind of concerned, and the tendency would be to offer him respects like that. And Prabhupada explains very interestingly that this tendency of, what Indra did, he was cheating basically. He was dressing up as a saintly person, but he wasn't a saintly person, you know. A saintly person, we understand, is free from envy. We read in Bhagavad Gita that free from envy and free from the desire to covet another's possessions. In general, we understand that to mean somebody else's wife, like that, not to be lusting after somebody else's wife. But in this case, we can understand it that you know, the sacrifice, the 100th sacrifice, was Maharaj Prithu's possession, if you like, and Indra was envious of that and lusting after that, so he stole the horse. But then he dressed as a sannyasi, so he wasn't qualified to do that. So this tendency to cheat like that, and probably explains, this is the beginning. Indra was the first one to do that, and ever since Indra did that, you have this tendency for people to be hypocrites, to cheat, to pretend to be something that they're not. Prabhupada refers to them also as Vraja Vatus, or charlatan meditators, in the Bhagavad Gita, and describes how this is, of course Prabhupada talks many, many times in the Bhagavatam about the cheaters and the cheated. And of course, you have both types of personalities or people in the material world, those who actually want to be cheated and those who are happy to cheat. And you can't actually have one without the other. Here's a very important point. And it's interesting in this, as I say, who Krishna and Lord Brahma are looking to take responsibility. So our tendency is, and certainly the tendency, not necessarily among devotees, but certainly the tendency in the material world, is to actually blame the cheaters. If somebody cheats somebody in some financial dealing, or if somebody cheats somebody in any other dealing or aspect of life, if the legal system gets involved, then they pursue the cheater and see what he's done or what she's done. And if they find that they've done something wrong, then they will be prosecuted and ultimately punished in some way, either fined or maybe go to prison or whatever the case may be. They don't actually pursue the cheated and find out what the cheated person did wrong and then prosecute them and give them some punishment. They don't actually do that. But if you read Prabhupada's purports on when he's discussing these subject matters, he makes very little distinction between the cheaters and the cheated. Because without people who want to be cheated, you cannot have cheaters. You can't have them. Because they won't succeed. And then going back to the letter that Prabhupada wrote to Karandar, that he wanted a society of independently thoughtful people. And of course, independently thoughtful people, one of the qualities of an independently thoughtful person would be that they would not be able to be cheated like that. So it's just food for thought. Because now what's happening is, Lord Brahma initially, and now Lord Vishnu, are actually requesting Prithu Maharaj to forgive Lord Indra for what Lord Indra has done. Maharaj Prithu did nothing wrong, and they're making the point that as a person in Krishna consciousness or in elevated consciousness, why would you want to punish anybody? Why would you want to be vindictive? Why would you want to hold a grudge? And I think the quote is given at some point in one of the translations, that the more that we seek justice, even though externally seeking that justice is justified, is okay, externally seeking that is okay, the more that we endeavor to do that and seek to punish somebody, the more we get entangled in the material world. So it's just very interesting, the whole thing between the cheaters and the cheated and who has to take responsibility. So at all times, I think Prabhupada also gives that wonderful turn of phrase. Every time I speak here, I always mention about Prabhupada's incredible command of the English language. I don't think there's very many English people, English-speaking people, even the great writers, that have a better command of the English language than Srila Prabhupada ever had. But Prabhupada's wonderful turn of course, he did also, just to balance that, Prabhupada did also quote some famous English literary people. He quoted Cowper quite often, the famous one saying that man built the city and God built the country. He quoted Shakespeare, "The quality of mercy is not strained, it droppeth as gentle rains from the heavens above. It is twice blessed." And actually, that quote of Shakespeare is very relevant here, because that's essentially what's being requested of Maharaj Prithu, that he should show mercy in this situation and compassion. So that turn of phrase that Prabhupada had was, do not resent the agents of your karma. Do not resent the agents of your karma. Karma, our karma, karma in general, but our karma, because it's good to internalize it. Our karma is the best educational tool available to us. It's the best educational facility that we have, like that, to help us understand our plight in the material world and to more and more develop our faith in the process of devotional service in Krishna consciousness. So Prabhupada's very, very clear, do not resent the agents of your karma, because actually they're your educators and they're your best friend. Ultimately, they're your best friend because they're helping us in our journey, our path of devotional service, like that. So Prithu Maharaj was being requested now to forgive Lord Indra. And the verse that we're on now is explaining that if you're a living entity within the material world, but you're in a state of Krishna consciousness, you won't be affected by the modes of material nature. And it's the modes of nature that are pulling us down to these lower these lower stages or lower scenarios where we're affected by things like jealousy and envy, and we're affected by revenge and wanting to seek justice, like that. Actually, in that story, it's amazing, you know, because Prabhupada quotes that, "The quality of mercy is not strained, that droppeth as gentle rains from the heavens above." It's like that reference in Bhagavatam, where the rain is so generous that the rain falls everywhere. It doesn't just fall on the desert where it's needed, or it doesn't just fall on the farmer's crops that he's just sown where it's needed, but it also falls on the ocean as well. It falls everywhere because it's so liberal. So in the same way, that quote of Shakespeare is making that reference that the quality of mercy should be unlimited. We should have unlimited mercy in our hearts for all living entities. Also, it's referring in this verse and purport that you should have the purport is that there should be compassion for all living entities. And I remember discussing here at Gopaneem one verse from Bhagavatam where the phrase Shema Darshina was used. And Shema Darshana means that a Krishna conscious person should have this quality of compassion for all living entities, like that. So this quote of Shakespeare is very interesting because it's made by a lawyer. The lawyer's name is Portia, and she's actually a lady, but she's dressed up as a man, I think because in medieval Italian society, that a woman wasn't taken so seriously, or not as seriously as a man. So she actually dressed up as a man, and she was the lawyer for a Christian person called Antonio. And Antonio was trying to provide for his family, and he needed some money. As we all know, if you're grihastas and you're starting a business, you need some, what we call here, is a common phrase here in Mayapur, we need some seed capital to start up a business. So Antonio, he needed some seed capital to start up his business, and he had nothing. So, as was the norm then in medieval Italian society, is also the norm now in in Western society at least, is that the Jewish people tended to have money, and they tended to come, or they tended to be the banking fraternity. So Antonio, he went to a personality called Shylock, who was a Jewish man, and he was a banker. And he went to Shylock and he asked him for a loan to start his business. So in modern day society, if you go to a bank to ask for a loan, they will want some collateral or some asset to put against their loan. In the case that you don't repay them, they can claim that asset. So nowadays it's usually some property or something like that, some guarantee that someone gives them, that in the case that you don't pay the loan, they can take this and they get their money back. In medieval Italy at the time, maybe among other things that you could give as collateral, what was given in this particular case was signed into the small print of the contract, was if you default on this payment, I'm entitled to take a pound of flesh from the area of your heart. A pound of flesh. Which would be maybe, you know, maybe about that much. So if it's taken from the heart, there's a good chance that you won't survive. So, because also the person who takes it is the person who lent you the money, not a heart surgeon, so he wouldn't be very expert. So anyway, Antonio failed to repay the loan. He invested his money in the business, and the business went kaput, as many of us probably have that experience of our business efforts going kaput. And then Shylock, the banker, wanted his money back. So Antonio could not pay, so it went to court. And it was in the court that Antonio's lawyer, her name was Portia, dressed as a man, she was pleading. She said, yes, according to the contract, you are right. You are right. But I am pleading to you as a human being to show some compassion, to show some mercy. And hence she quoted this, the quality of mercy is not strained. It droppeth as gentle rains from the heavens above. It is twice blessed. But he didn't listen to that. And he insisted on getting his pound of flesh. So one of the court aides went and came back with a knife, sharp knife, and gave him the knife. And Antonio was brought, held by two guards or more, and he was brought to where Shylock was standing. And his shirt was taken off like that. And Shylock had the knife, and he went to cut his pound of flesh from as close to the heart as possible. And just as he was about to make the first incision, Portia, the lawyer, intervened and said, Judge, I have one more thing to say. May I? And the judge said, yes. And she said, in the contract, it says that you can take a pound of flesh, not 1 ounce less, not 1 ounce more. Also, it does not say that you can draw blood. So you have to take a pound of flesh, not 1 ounce less, not 1 ounce more, and you cannot draw blood. If you do, then according to the contract, you also are punishable by death. So Shylock, being on the bodily platform and being attached, he, in humiliation, had to withdraw. So he lost his money, and he wasn't able to fulfill his thing of getting the pound of flesh from Antonio. However, the reason I relay that story now, I wasn't going to, it just came into my head, but the reason I relayed it was that he was given the opportunity to be merciful. He was given that opportunity to be merciful, and he declined that opportunity. And then he ended up declining the opportunity to be merciful, but also not getting what he thought was his just rights, a pound of flesh. So he left the courtroom totally ashamed and totally embarrassed and totally humiliated. And it's just a lesson for us that, you know, our karma will come and get us. We can't avoid our karma. It will come and get us. It's like that chakra following daksha at all moments. It's right on our shoulder at all times. Or it's like a lion ready to pounce at all times. It's always there coming to get us. So it's so much better for us, and it makes us feel so much better, and it's so much more wholesome if at all times we make the correct decisions in terms of being compassionate and being devotees, basically. So this is the point that is being made to Lord Indra, sorry, to Prithu Maharaj in this particular section of the Bhagavatam. That he's, if he is in this consciousness, if he is in full knowledge of the Paramatma and the Atma, he's never affected by the modes of material nature, and therefore is situated in Krishna's loving transcendental service. And then in the purport, Prabhupada quotes Rupa Goswami, and he says that if one is always engaged in the service of the Lord with his body, words and mind, he is to be considered liberated, although living in the material world. So Prabhupada gives the example, actually, of you have the liberated person who is beyond the modes of nature. And of course Rupa Goswami also explains all the different stages of devotional life that we go through, and then when we reach the stages of bhava and the stages of prem, that from those stages we cannot fall down, and we enter into these incredible loving relationships with the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whereby if we get a chance to meet Krishna, even though the circumstances surrounding that chance are incredibly difficult, austere and problematic, those austerities, problems and difficulties become absolute nectar, because the result is that we get to meet Krishna. Whereas if we're in a perfectly wonderful, blissful, nectarine situation, but there is no opportunity to meet Krishna, then that perfect, beautiful, blissful, nectarine situation becomes absolutely hellish, because there is no opportunity to meet Krishna. That we intertwine ourselves, the beloved and the loved, intertwine themselves so much that any pain, even subtle pain, experienced by the other, is experienced by the other like that. And all these incredible exchanges of Vipralamba and Vishramba and all these different incredible stages. So Rupa Goswami is also explaining that, but here he's explaining that if we're engaged in the devotional process, then we are to be considered liberated. And Prabhupada gives the example of the postman. And the postman, as long as he's doing his job properly and delivering the mail like that, and collecting the mail and delivering it, that he's rightly situated. So as devotees, as long as we're doing that, we're properly situated in our devotional service, in our devotional life, then we're considered liberated. And regardless, you know, as Krishna tells us in Bhagavad Gita 3:33, that even a man in knowledge does not deny his nature and engages in an occupation according to that nature, because what will repression accomplish like that? So whatever our nature is, whatever our varna is, you know, from the elevated varna of the brahminical varna, where, you know, all these wonderful qualities of cleanliness and austerity and detachment and, you know, devotion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, all these wonderful qualities, to the qualities of a sudra who is just serving his master, whoever he may be, serving the Brahmins and the Brahmanas and the cows, and he's satisfied with whatever income, whatever wealth comes from that. But it doesn't matter if you're properly situated within one of those varnas and engaged in devotional service, you will actually achieve perfection. But within that, Rupa Goswami is explaining that, and let me just read that again, that if a person is always engaged in the service of the Lord with his body, mind and words, he's considered liberated, although living in the material world. It also isn't something that we should take cheaply. If we think of a few verses from Bhagavad Gita, the first one that comes to mind is 3:30, where Krishna says, Mayi sarvani karmani sanyasyatma chetaza nirashir nimamubhutva yujasva vigatashvara. And because of my bad learning techniques when I was a brahmachari a long time ago, I will actually get the verse to read the English to make sure I get the English exactly correct. So, Mayi sarvani karmani sanyasyatma chetaza nirashir nimamubhutva yujasva vikatashvara. Therefore, O Arjuna, surrendering all your works unto me, with full knowledge of me, without desire for profit, with no claims to proprietorship, and free from lethargy, fight. So here we see a reference of having full knowledge of Krishna, and that's what this translation is saying. One situated in full knowledge of Paramatma and the Atma is never affected by the modes of material nature. So here Krishna is giving a definition of what full knowledge of him actually is. So full knowledge of Krishna, in Arjuna's case, full knowledge of Krishna means that he would surrender all his works unto Krishna. That he'd have no desire for profit, no desire whatsoever for profit. So when you think of the material world, Prabhupada explains the material world functions on kind of one principle, you could say two, but really one principle, and that is the desire for profit that means people can enjoy sex life. Prabhupada says that. The material world spins because of the desire for sex life. So of course sex life, at least among the human beings, is quote unquote more available and more, I don't know if more pleasurable is the right word, but if you have money, because then you can, you know, get as many partners as you want and have really nice palatial surroundings and whatever you want like that. So money and sex are two things that are very closely connected. And we see in the material world, in order to get money, people have to work. They have to do some work like that. So could you imagine the city of Calcutta, which of course now at whatever time it is, 8:45 in the morning, is already buzzing. You can just imagine going to the different marketplaces in Calcutta now. It is heaving and thriving, and the exchanges that are taking place in those marketplaces for money, because people want to earn money like that. So all these people are working. Could you imagine if you said to all these people, listen, I want you to do exactly the same thing that you're doing now, but you're not going to get any money for it. You're not going to get anything. Would they continue to work? There's just no chance in this world that any of these people would continue to work if you told them they weren't getting any money like that. So, without desire for profit. So this is what Krishna is saying to Arjuna. You have to work without any desire for profit. With no claim to proprietorship. So that's the other thing. When we get money, then we buy things. And we identify, this is my car, this is my house, you know, this is my jacuzzi, this is my whatever it might be, this is my wife, this is my husband. So this immediate claim for proprietorship. And we see, you know, the conflict in Kashmir, is it Kashmir? Yeah, the conflict in Kashmir between, again, you know, basically India and Pakistan, Hindu-Muslim conflict over land. This is my land, this is our land. Conflict, and you look at any conflict in the world, it's because of a claim. Someone has claimed proprietorship over it, like that. And actually tying that in with the point that in this story where Lord Indra dresses as a sannyasi to try to escape the scene, stealing the horse. I remember Bill Clinton, he came to Ireland maybe when he was president, maybe 10 years ago, something like that. I don't know how long ago it was. Oh, I think Eden Agri saying 20 years ago. Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, it's amazing how time flies. Anyway, he came to Ireland, and he was preaching. Essentially, he was preaching to the Protestants, the kind of British Protestants in Northern Ireland. And he was saying to them, you know, at some point you're going to have to accept this is Ireland, you know. Because there was a dispute between the British Protestants and the Irish Catholics. And he was kind of making the point, really, Ireland is really the Catholics, it's Ireland, you know. So you, at some point you're going to have to accept this. And I remember when he was speaking like this, just this point about being hypocrites. And being forgetful, as living entities were very forgetful. The British Protestants have been in Ireland for 800 years. They've been there for 800 years. The white Americans have only been in America for less than 300. So here's a white American telling people who've been connected to that place for 800 years, a white American who's only been connected to his country for 300 years, getting on their case that they should accept that it's owned by somebody else. Well, hey Bill, what about the Native Americans? Maybe you should give them some consideration in regards to ownership. So no claim to proprietorship. We have no claim to proprietorship. So we're not going to take any money for our work, for our endeavors. We're not going to claim any proprietorship for our endeavors. And then Krishna says, and now you go and fight, because that was Arjuna's job, to fight. You go and do your duty, you fight, completely free of any lethargy. I don't know how many devotees in this room have ran businesses or ran a business, but even when you pay your employees a good wage, they're still lethargic. They still don't really want to work, even when they're getting a nice pay packet at the end of the week. So here Krishna is saying, no profit, no proprietorship. You fight completely with full vigor and enthusiasm. You just go and fight. So that's what we're talking about when this verse says that we read today, when this verse says full knowledge of the Paramatma, then you're not affected by the modes of material nature. So yes, Prabhupada gave the example of the postman, but actually, you know, and we're like in that role of the postman or the postwoman. There's lots of postwomen these days too. So postman or postwoman, we're in that role. But hey, we also have to be realistic about what it means to be in full knowledge, to transcend from the postman platform to the actual genuinely liberated platform. Not genuinely liberated, but liberated, internally liberated onto that platform. And then just a few more verses. You have Yuktaram. Where are we now? Let me see. Let's get the English translation. Yeah, Bhaktaram Yogyatapasham Sarvaloka Maheshwaram 529. And it's a person in full consciousness of me, in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifices and austerities, the supreme lord of all planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. So again, when we're in full consciousness of Krishna and who he actually is, then and only then can we attain peace from the pangs of material miseries like that. So again, to actually transcend the modes of nature. And then there are quite a lot of verses in the seventh chapter, if I can pull some of them out. Well, first in text 13, deluded by the three modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. So here's somebody who's deluded by those modes. We're talking about transcending them. So here's a person who's deluded by the modes of nature. The whole world does not know me. So if you're transcendent to the modes of nature, then the quality or the definition of that is that you're in full consciousness of Krishna. But if you're not, then the definition is you do not know him. You do not know Krishna at all. And Krishna, who is above the modes and inexhaustible. And then we have uh, 7:18. All these devotees, undoubtedly magnanimous souls, situated in knowledge of me, I consider to be just like my own self. Being engaged in my transcendental service, they are sure to attain me, the highest and most perfect goal. So those magnanimous souls who are situated in knowledge of Krishna. After many births and deaths, he who is actually in knowledge surrenders unto me, knowing me to be the cause of all causes and all that is. Such a great soul is very rare. And then one of my favorite verses in the Bhagavad Gita, Etam vibhutam yogam cha mama yoveti tatvataha zovikalpena yogena yujate natra samshaya. And that verse reads, one who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So if we have any doubt as to whether we are still functioning on the platform of a postman, or have we internally reached the Brahma-Bhuta platform and transcended the modes of material nature, if we're a little bit unsure about that, where we are we still functioning as the postman, or have we actually transcended, in our own right, have we transcended the modes of nature, then we just have to read that verse. One who is factually convinced of this opulence and mystic power of mine engages in unalloyed devotional service. Of this there is no doubt. So if we're engaged in unalloyed devotional service, then we can actually begin to start believing that we have transcended the modes of material nature. And then the sister verse from chapter 15, the Yoga of the Supreme Person, the sister verse of 10.7 is 15.19. Whoever knows me as the Supreme Personality of Godhead without doubting is the knower of everything. He therefore engages himself in full devotional service to me, O son of Bharat. So, when we do that, when we have actually achieved that, either if we're acting perfectly on the platform of the postman, or we have actually genuinely transcended the modes of nature, we will act like Prithu Maharaj acted here and forgive Lord Indra and act in that, in that devotional mood at all times. At all times, that is how we will act. And just going back to achieving this, we're talking about achieving these different stages of devotional life where we're free from all desires and free from all anartas, and that we're actually, you know, the perfect recipients of Krishna's, of engaging in devotional service and being able to serve Krishna perfectly like that. And then, of course, when we and the point I'm making here is that we understand who Krishna actually is, that we actually understand who Krishna actually is, and know him in full knowledge of me. When actually we've achieved that platform, then, just like the gopis, we then have to forget who Krishna is, because we can't see him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, because then that will affect that particular rasa, that particular conjugal rasa. So that then is the actual, just an amazing scenario, that we're in material consciousness. It's very, very important that we know who Krishna is and understand him as who he is, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in order to help us in our devotional life to surrender, to be humble, to get rid of our false ego, etc. Really, really, really have to understand the super extraordinary position of Krishna, the Supreme Personality. But of course, when we've actually achieved that, then we have to forget him, forget who he is. Okay, I will stop there. It's nearly 9 o'clock, and if anybody has any questions or comments, and Vasudev never has any questions or comments, so, you know, I knew he wasn't going to put up his hand. And then Yasomati, is it? Krishna Lal, from yesterday. Sorry.
Thank you, Prabhu. It's about this question of wages. You mentioned that no one will work for nothing. However, Krishna does guarantee that he will maintain his devotees. And I think there is no question of working without having something, some allowance for one's family to live. In fact, most of the world, most workers, they work for hardly just enough to maintain their families. So there is no question of not earning wages for that. So there seems to be a bit of a misunderstanding there. That of course karmis won't work for nothing. They need their families to be fed. What is the difference between that and devotees also having to get their wages for their families to be fed?
Yeah, you know, sometimes when you give examples or you give it from one perspective to make the point that you're trying to make, you know. Of course, you know, there's no issue with receiving a wage. Although having said that, you know, in an ideal society, there wouldn't actually be transaction of currency. That's a whole sociological discussion about what the ideal society is and how people should be maintained. But just in terms of basic maintenance, it's understood. I mean, that's another quality of a king like King Prithu. King Prithu was understood to be, you know, an example of the topmost type of ruler or king, because he actually made the citizens happy and they wanted for nothing. They actually wanted for nothing like that. So basic maintenance is a given. People obviously have to have their basic maintenance, and Prabhupada explains that people cannot practice Krishna consciousness unless they're in a peaceful state of mind. And part of being in a peaceful state of mind is you have somewhere to sleep at night that's clean and warm, and you have enough food to eat during the day, so you're not feeling hungry. So yeah, basic maintenance, and then the idea is anything over and above that you use in the service of Krishna, like that. So it's all to do with consciousness. You know, there's nothing wrong. I mean, you know, Prabhupada said, Bhaktisiddhanta said, that, you know, a devotee, you know, $1 million a day is not enough for a devotee, because he's using that in Krishna's service. And because he's using it in Krishna's service, and because Krishna's service is unlimited, then $1 million is not enough, because as soon as he gets $1 million, then he's, you know, Ambarish Prabhu needs another $30 million to complete this building. So you get $1 million, put it there, and you won't even notice the difference. So it's all to do with consciousness. If your consciousness is Krishna conscious, then yeah, you can have as much wealth as you want. But yeah, the point is valid, that in our society, people have... I was simply just trying to make the point that Arjuna was... This was the point, no desire for profit. So I suppose if you equate profit with that that is over and above the basic maintenance, then that profit shouldn't be desired. Or if it is desired, it should be desired to use in Krishna's service.
At the beginning of your class, you quoted a very favorite letter of yours from Srila Prabhupada about this Krishna conscious movement is training
independently thoughtful people.
Could you elaborate on that a little bit more, if you can?
I fear if I elaborate on that, I'll say something controversial. I mean, it's kind of like, in one sense, it's sort of self-explanatory, independently thoughtful, like that. Prabhupada also says that a devotee should surrender everything except their intelligence. So they should, you know, engage their intelligence. Because going back to this subject of the cheaters and the cheated, that if you surrender your intelligence and you don't allow yourself to be independently thoughtful, then it's very easy for you to become cheated. Very, very easy for you to become cheated. And as I also mentioned, I stand to be corrected on this point, but I don't see that Srila Prabhupada makes much of a distinction between the cheaters and the cheated. He seems to blame them both equally. That at least is my interpretation of what Prabhupada said. Because Prabhupada says many kind of, on the face of it, controversial things. You know, he said Churchill was more of a demon than Hitler. You know, he said that, you know, apartheid in South Africa, at least the concept of it, is a good concept. You know, so Prabhupada said many, many controversial things. But when you unpack them, you can understand why he said those things. If you take, for instance, Africa, arguably, you know, as far as continents go, it's the with the black Africans ruling the different countries that they rule in Africa, it's arguably the worst administered continent on the planet, you know. So then you can start to see Prabhupada's comment making sense, you know, in that particular context like that. Of course, Prabhupada wasn't supporting the cruelty that the apartheid system came with, not at all. But he was supporting good management and administration in terms of how things should function. So, so the cheaters and the cheated. I don't see, if you had put the blacks in charge, in fact, I know quite a few Indian devotees of South African origin, and I know quite a few black devotees of South African origin, and they actually, and I know quite a few white devotees of South African origin, but they actually tell me during the apartheid system that the black people in particular, they much preferred having a white quote-unquote master than an Indian master. Because the whites were in charge, they were in control, they were the supreme masters, so they tended to be less cruel, less sort of demanding, less sort of heavy. Whereas the Indians, because they were middle masters, they were still being dominated by the whites, when they got an opportunity to lord over, boy, did they take it, you know? So the black people that I know, the devotees, they say, we didn't want Indians being in charge of us because they were much heavier than the white people being in charge. So this tendency to lord over is in every single living entity. It's in the whites, it's in the blacks, it's in the Indians, it's in the Chinese, it's in all of us to lord over. So if we're given the opportunity, regardless of our skin color or our ethnic background, if we're not Krishna conscious, we will lord over. So the cheaters and the cheated. One day you're being cheated, next day you have an opportunity to cheat, and you're cheating, and you have victims who are the cheaters. So Prabhupada didn't make a distinction. So in the same way, this example of Indra, if Indra has just done this and he's stolen the horse from the, and it was Prithu Maharaj's grandson, was it, that didn't immediately recognize, he just thought, oh, he's a sannyasi, so he didn't intervene. But was it Lord Brahma, I think? Was it Lord Brahma? Or somebody told him that no, he's cheating, he's pretending. So my Prabhupada's point, my understanding of independently thoughtful is, we wouldn't need somebody to tell us, oh, Indra is a fake. He's cheating here. Sorry, my mobile phone is ringing because I have an appointment at 9 o'clock, I just remembered. Anyway, so independently thoughtful means we would be able to recognize that. We wouldn't need somebody to tell us that this person is a fake, that we would recognize it. Because we've allowed ourselves to become Krishna conscious in an independently thoughtful way, like that. And not that we're going to be suckers to be cheated, like that. And that's what Prabhupada said. That's what he wanted. Independently thoughtful people. He didn't want blind followers. You know, he didn't want people who were like zombies, you know. You know. And people, and you look at it. You look at the devotees that he really appreciated in his own leela. You know, devotees like, well, so many of them actually. But you know, devotees like Tamal Krishnamurti. You know. Was Tamal Krishnamurti the type of person you think you could easily fool? That you could easily trick? You know? I mean, Tamal Krishnamurti would be the type of devotee that if Indra was leaving and dressed as a sannyasi with the horse, he would say, hey, get him! You know, he's a cheat, you know, rascal, you know? You know? And they were the devotees that Prabhupada really appreciated. Devotees who took risks, devotees who really had a mind of their own, you know, who knew what Prabhupada's desires were, what Prabhupada wanted. So yeah, independently thoughtful. We see, we call a spade a spade. You know, what do the Americans always say? That phrase that really drives me nuts, and I'm going to actually quote it now. You know, if it walks like a duck, if it splashes like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, it's a duck. You know, if it turns around and tries to tell you that it's a pigeon, then no, it's not a pigeon. You know, it's a duck. You know, so in the same way, you know, a devotee, Bhagavad Gita tells us, you know, how a devotee walks, how he talks, you know, what he, etc., etc., etc. So by the activities, by the fruit you can tell the tree, and by the activities you can tell, you know, what platform somebody is on in their Krishna consciousness. And even if someone else is trying to tell you differently, you should have the strength of character, you should have the courage of your convictions to, you know, identify what you think is actually the real situation and act on that level. I stopped you the last day, Prabhu, for time, so yeah, I'll take that call. I'm supposed to be somewhere at 9 o'clock. I want to hear your question.
Really easy if you have, first of all, Lord Brahma, and then you have Lord Vishnu telling you to forgive. Okay, that makes it easy. Okay? We see other pastimes of the Lord, like, for example, pure devotees, like Bhima. He wasn't ready to forgive, and his refusal to forgive is glorified as real manly behavior in line with the desire of Lord Krishna and others. So, my question is, how do we know when to forgive and when not to forgive? Because sometimes the natural tendency of devotees is they want to forgive. But sometimes you get people who you think this person just should not be forgiven. They're just, you know, I've seen too much, you know. So that's my question. How do you know when to forgive and not to forgive when you don't have Lord Krishna or Lord Brahma telling you personally?
Yeah, very nice question. Very nice question. The first part of it, it's true. If you have Lord Vishnu and Lord Brahma, they are requesting you. You would logically think it's easier. Although having said that, when Krishna is personally present in his own leela, when Lord Chaitanya was personally present, he also had people who didn't accept him as the Supreme Personality of Godhead and challenged him and defied him. And I don't think it's axiomatic or automatic that just because you're being requested. I mean, this verse is telling us when you're in full knowledge of the Paramatma. So Paramatma is in all of our hearts. So in that sense, the Paramatma at all times is there, prodding us and cajoling us. But hey, you know, are we listening? Are we taking note? So that's just one comment on the first part of your question. On the second part, yeah, that's why we have to become independently thoughtful to know when it's correct to forgive and when it's correct not to. And also in the example that you give, or similar examples, sometimes depending on the pastime and depending on the situation, you know, Krishna may not want you to be forgiving in that particular circumstance to actually underscore or underline a more important point in that particular situation that is present. But as we know, in all of these situations, once the person who is seeking forgiveness or others are seeking forgiveness on their behalf, when that seeking of forgiveness is absolutely genuine, 100% genuine, then I'm not sure that there are examples where we still don't, where the devotee still isn't expected or shouldn't forgive. But in any given stage of the process, there may be, in this case you're mentioning, there may be a bona fide example where somebody stands up and says no, and is glorified as a result of doing that. Even in the pastime of Jagai and Madai, there were different stages, particularly before Madai received full forgiveness. There was resistance ultimately from Lord Chaitanya. So there are different stages in the actual process. So, but yeah, that requires us two things. One, to be independently thoughtful, and two, to Tesham Satata Yuktanam, Bhajitam Pratibhavakam, to actually be in reasonable tune with the super soul, that we can pray to the super soul to give us the correct direction in any given circumstance. Because ultimately, independently thoughtful and using our own intelligence, that alone isn't enough. We can't depend on that for always getting it right. There has to be inspiration from the super soul, and that will only come if we have the correct consciousness, and then the super soul can guide us. But I'm going to go now. I'm sorry for this. Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki.